This is Perry, and I'm here with John Fox. And John Fox was one of my early mentors because about 8 years ago, John played a part in hiring me to work at a company where we subsequently worked together for a couple years and did a lot of sales and marketing projects, most of which were really actually successful, and played a part in getting a small company off the ground. That company was Synergetic Microsystems. And John has a company called Venture Marketing in the Chicago area. And John works mostly with very small companies and making the entrepreneur's vision happen. And so, John, welcome.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
It's great to have you here. Just to flesh out the story a little more, this would have been about 8 years ago. I had a job interview at this company called Synergetic, and the president of the company and John, who was a consultant at the time, were both interviewing me. And John asked me this question, which later he told me was one of the most important questions. He said something like, let's say that we didn't have a big budget for you to get on a plane and go a bunch of different places and see all these customers. How would you deal with that? And I said, well, I would find a way for them to buy without me going to see them.
Right.
And that turned out to be the right kind of an answer.
That's true.
Because they didn't have a budget for all of that. And the interesting thing about it for me was it created a complete opposite situation of what I was used to, where what I was used to was a kind of job where Here's the phone book. Here's a manufacturer's directory.
Right.
I want you to dial the phone until you get yourself a ticket to leave this office and be gone as much as possible, as long as possible, seeing customers. Okay?
Right.
Ready, set, go. Right?
That's right.
Pound the phone, leave.
Right. Right.
Okay. And it created a situation where I always had to be inviting myself into somebody's business and into somebody's life. And it was very hard. As a matter of fact, I think in the last 10 or 15 years ago, that sort of thing has got harder and harder and harder and harder. But I was suddenly in a situation where it was the opposite, where I now had to tell customers, well, if they asked me if I could come see them, I'd have to say, well, no, I'm sorry. I'm not planning to come your way anymore. Or right at this moment, but maybe I can help you. And the internet was just getting going. Mm-hmm. Our kind of customers were starting to get on the web in a big way because they were engineers. And that turned out to be like a key to success.
Right.
All of a sudden, I wasn't chasing people, and all of a sudden, they wanted to talk to me.
Right.
It's like, wow. And I had like about a year of therapy where I actually healed from my wounds of...
I'm glad I was a part of that.
Well, you were.
Right.
You were. And there were a number of things that you helped us put in place. The website, a marketing message. You did some research to find out what our customer base was prior to me showing up. We came up with this. You came up with a slide chart that ended up being very successful. Could you talk about, I mean, with that kind of introduction, could you talk about what happened?
In fact,
there?
You know, you saying that question, and working with literally hundreds of companies now that have been pre-funding, many with, as you said, taking the idea and the energy of an entrepreneur and really playing that out into a real business. The days of getting on an airplane and going to see somebody for no apparent reason is gone.
Yeah.
Unless you happen to have some incredible budget. But for the most part, real world, that's just not where it's at today. And it reminds me, I wasn't a Boy Scout, but I remember one of my friends was. And he said, you know, if somebody goes overboard, what Boy Scouts teach you is this simple mantra, which is reach, rope, row, tow.
Reach?
I'm sorry, reach, rope. I'll say it again. Reach, rope, row, go. And the way that is that the first thing you do is you try to reach into the water and help them. Those are the people that are pretty close by. And then if you have a rope, you kind of throw that out there and you try to drag them in. And if you can't do that, then you get in a boat and then you go try to grab them. the last thing you do is go jump in the water and go grab them because so many people die doing that.
Right.
Now, let me tell you, that is very true of small business where you think the way you're going to provide revenue and drive revenue is by getting in the water with your customer, not knowing if they're going to survive or not, and getting right in there in the mix with them.
Oh.
And so, you know, it just reminds me of we restricted you at that time from going out to see a lot of people. And I think the principle actually was pretty close to reach, row, go.
Absolutely.
So.
It was. Well, one of the first conversations we had was, well, we got this database. I think it was like maybe a couple of thousand people who had called or contacted or whatever.
Yeah.
And you had this website.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, well, make some sense out of all this.
Right.
And nobody really knew what was out there.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that the thing for your listeners here, most valuable, what can they walk away from a conversation with me? You know, I think that it's probably more important to really focus our time on some things that just clearly don't work. Things that we want to believe work, but they really don't work.
Yeah.
And I've read enough of your material to recognize that you talk about a lot of those. And I guess I'll probably just pour more fuel on the fire for those things. But one of those issues really is making a gigantic assumption of who your customer is. And I think if you peeled on all the layers of the onion in my book, the simple or the central focus of the book is really, really get to know who your customers are and their pain points and their problems. Because once you do that, you are able to construct a marketing program that's going to support your sales team.
Yep.
Now, you were mentioning this slide chart that we did at Synergetic, and I'll use that as an illustration. My first work at the organization was to figure out, okay, we're not starting at zero. We're starting at some bit of revenue. But at the time, this company was a consulting firm who was doing just a little bit of work in products. And I analyzed some of the raw internet traffic. This is before we actually had any kind of decent tools. And it was obvious that a huge percentage, I'm saying like 80% of the people that visited the website, were coming to it for one reason. And the one reason was to get a fair comparison of, and what we had, the founder of the company had developed. And I don't know why, probably for in response to an RFQ and then put it up on the website for reference material. But it was a very fair comparison of many different kinds of network technology.
Right.
And and we were getting, at the time, as I remember, 500 to 1,000 visitors every month. And this is in a small market at the time.
Right.
Who are coming to the website.
And the internet, this is 97.
Right. Yeah. Right. What internet, right?
Right.
Yeah. No images, right? It's just text. And we had a table. And it was, as I said, it was a very fair comparison of technology. I mean, you remember this.
Yep.
And so I started asking, how do we make some money on this? Well, as it turned out, we started to slice and dice that data. And it helped us understand on that, what kind of people were coming there, what were they looking for, and how that got into a slide chart is that the president decided to make the decision of going to a trade show. And at the time, trade shows were a very, very big venue. And this trade show happened to be National Manufacturing Week, which was held in Chicago every year. The firm was located in Chicago, so the travel issues were something that we didn't really have to deal with. And we got a small booth. And we just happened to luck out, and the booth we got was right at the main entrance.
Yep.
And, you know, what the president, I have to say, complimented him. He made an investment in some marketing material, which was taking this table off of the website, and I reconstructed it into a slide chart, the kind of slide chart you're familiar with that Weight Watchers might hand out for a calories versus consumption scale.
Yeah.
And we put that into a slide chart, and then we handed these out thousands at a time at this trade show. And it cost us, as I remember, the printing cost was maybe 78 cents each. And so it wasn't the most inexpensive giveaway, but it certainly was less than giving away T-shirts.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And what it did for the organization is that it made Synergetic, for the first time, look like experts in their business. Right. And that's one of the things that you'll see come out loud and strong in my my work, especially in the book, that if you are a small business person and you are just starting out, most important thing you can do is to look like an expert. And one thing that we all know that experts do is, like yourself, you give away information, you give away knowledge, you package in such a way that it's easy for people to read and follow you. And if they want more and they want to sit in a class, well, that's a charge item, if you will. And so that's something that we were able to do for Synergetic that really put them in the next category.
Can I just...
Please.
That little chart, well, there's another bit of perspective, is that in any new market, especially, or any new area, or the, I mean, this could be alternative health, this could be real estate, this could,
right,
you can always find these areas where there's a lot of confusion,
right,
where most people they've heard these buzzwords and they don't really know what they mean, and there's six different ways to do something and they don't know which one is best, and they ask simplistic questions that usually require, you know, careful answers, mm-hmm. right? And that's exactly what was going on in that industry with those technologies at the time. And so we created a tool that gave clarity,
right,
in the middle of the confusion.
Right, but we didn't have an axe to grind either. We didn't play favorites. So
right.
We really looked like we right. were trying to be fair. And in all honesty, we were.
We were trying to be
right.
fair.
Right.
And that was actually our unique selling proposition. Now, not everybody in this situation is trying to be fair. Some people, mm-hmm. out of the six different options, they want to show people the one. However, you still got to eliminate the people that would choose the other ones anyway and then get rid of them.
Yeah.
So you still have to educate. You still have to. So we came into this, and it was just at the perfect time where everybody's hearing about it, but nobody's getting any education about it. And it doesn't make any sense, and it's all confusion and chaos. And we start handing out this little orange thing all over the place.
Right.
And people would look at it for about 2 seconds. They go, hey, this is really cool. And they would stick it in there. And here's what happened is, for the next 6 months after that trade show, about once a week, some distributor from Bohunk, Iowa, or from, you know, Alabama, or from Boston, or wherever, would call me up and say, hey, I got this chart somebody gave to me. Mm-hmm. Do you have more of these? Could you send me 25? Could you send me 50? I'm doing this little workshop, and I want to hand it out to all my customers.
Right.
And that got us all over the place. Right. I mean, it was the most amazing thing.
Yeah. Right.
It helped us find distributors. It helped us find us reps. One time, I had a call from a Fortune 500 company, I think the company was Amp, big connector
right,
company.
Amphenol, I think it was.
Yeah, Amphenol.
Right.
And they wanted to buy these things to hand out at their national sales conference, and they wanted to know how much they cost.
Right.
I put the phone on hold. I went and I came up with a price. I said 93 cents a piece, and I sold it to them.
And we were making money.
We were making money.
Right, right.
And I'll tell you, you know, that one little thing, and of course, let's not overlook Mike coming up with the idea to put it on the website, which that became really the basis of the company's web traffic for right. 3 or 4 years.
Yep.
I mean, that one idea
right.
of taking something confusing, it was so enormously helpful. And you know, there's all kinds of people giving away free reports and guides and white papers and all this. Hey, why not give away something even simpler than that?
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And I think that some of the things that we were able to accomplish is that because we had a really clear, and this is for your listeners who may be even just in the process of considering what business they're in. You know, to me, The basis of marketing is the three components. The first is that you have a full appreciation of what it is that you're selling. That is number one. So what are we selling? Number two is, how do we sell it? How do we distribute it? How do we get it out? Is it word of mouth? Is it through the distribution channel? Is it sold direct and so forth? So it's, how do we sell it? And then the third is, how do we paint it? And paint it means, what color is it? What's it look like? What's our logo? What's the name of the brand? And this is, you know, getting to then, what are some of the failures? I can't tell you how many companies reverse that order. Right? The first thing they think about is, what's the name of our company? What's the logo look like? What are our colors? What font choice do we have? What's the domain name that we have? Oh, our email address, right? Spend a lot of time in that. And then the next is, once they figure that out, then they say, let's figure out how we sell it, right? And then they finally get to, sometimes years later, so what is it that we're selling anyway, right? And smart companies operate in the correct order. So one thing that we had, if you want to use Synergetic as a great success story, and that is they had a very clear definition of what it was that they were selling. And so they were selling, just for your audience's sake, they were selling computer boards that talked to industrial networks.
Yep.
All right. Now, they were not in the business of consulting. They were not in the business of writing about it. They were really not in the services business and later got into the training business. Well, you know, there's an old phrase that a good friend of mine, Jeff Porter, came up with, and I still think it holds true. Jeff is now president of a very successful company called Scala. And he said, you know, the basic rules are always the same. And that is, if you're in the hardware business, give the software away for free. If you're in the software business, give the hardware away. And by the way, Microsoft is making a fortune out of following that. And so from Synergetic standpoint, the philosophy always was, and this is something that I believe I brought to the party, and that is, we're in the hardware business, so we're going to give away all that knowledge and the software, all the drivers, we're going to give it away for free,
right?
Right? Because we're going to drive our value through the sale of gear. And so when I think about your audience here, they have to have a really clear definition of what it is that they're selling. And once they understand that, then they can do the other thing, which is understand what they're not selling. Because the thing that they're not selling, they can decide to give away for free. Even though it has incredible value to the audience, they can put a price tag on it. And customers, by way of their own foot traffic, eyeball traffic to a website, will help you work through that.
Well, you know, the knowledge, I mean, we've been talking about the knowledge part, but, you know, that is a really important point, too, because the software in our case was the thing that made the hardware useful. And this was important in two ways. Is first of all, people would have to buy this hardware, but they would have to write their software to talk to it. Means their software would have to talk to our software.
Right.
And the ingeniousness of it was that once they wrote their software to talk to our hardware, that was a job they never ever wanted to go back and redo.
Right. Good point.
And so that made that locked them into a hardware choice that when they build this machine next month and the month after that, wherever they're selling, whoever they're selling it to, they're going to keep using our stuff.
Right.
And this was a really important strategic thing, because it would take anywhere from, you know, 3 months to a year and a half for our customer to do all that.
Right.
And that's all time that we have to wait to really get the sale going, and you don't want to have a 1 year sales process where you spend a year trying to sell them the thing, then they use it, then they switch to somebody else.
Right.
That would have killed us.
Right.
And so this, the education, it definitely tied into the stuff. It all fit together.
Right.
And, you know, to a person who's not in that particular business, you know, it's not really useful to explain all the reasons why that was, but there was a definite, can you explain, like, the general principles of how you put those pieces together? Because you've done this many times, not just once, and you
right.
used to work at Intel. And
right.
Can you talk about, what are the pieces of this?
Well, I think I can. I mean, at least I'll give it a try here. Some of what you're talking about really gets into understanding what are the barriers to entry because to any business, because the more in which you can put up barriers to your competition, the better. And in Synergetics' case, as an example, or I'll use another one, U.S. Robotics, where I was very early on with that company, which was in the modem business. God forbid anybody knows what a modem is. But, you know, they were a big, that was a big deal a few years ago, let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
And every modem behaves differently, just like in Synergetics' case, products behave differently. And there is a learning curve of anyone that wants to buy from you. And this is true of consulting firms and services. It's true of you having a new janitor come into your business and you have a contract with that janitorial service. There is an established relationship in which you have to, let's call it a gauntlet, that you have to earn that relationship, whether it's in software or hardware or services. It takes time to work with a new vendor, right? And sometimes it takes longer. And so what we recognized is that there's always an amount of time that somebody's willing to invest to, let's call it, vet a new vendor. And they are only going to want to work with so many vendors because after a while, their time of vetting is gone and they have to go on to do something else.
Yeah.
So it was important for us to establish a relationship very early on. And this kind of gets into another subject, but its subject is understand what your category is. And there's a lot written about that. If someone's not familiar with owning a category, I would ask them to check out Al Reese's book, which is now very old. It's called The 22 Immutable mm-hmm. Laws of Marketing.
Great
but
book.
It is one of the best marketing books out there and highly recommend it. It's probably on your recommended
Absolutely.
List.
Absolutely. Yeah. 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing.
Right. And so the point is that you may not be first, but you may be the first in a category. And, of course, categories can be created. It's up to you to define the category. And the reason I point that out is that if you can own a category and be first, then your customers are likely to only want to do business with a couple of vendors in that category. And then after that, you have to really do something stupid to lose the business, right? And so in U.S. Robotics' case, or in the case of Synergetic Microsystems, we worked very hard to be some of the very first people to supply them with the tools that they needed, which made it really easy for them to do business with us.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that standpoint, it really held at bay all of our competition. You know, one thing that's kind of interesting perspective is that after I worked at U.S. Robotics, I went to work at one of U.S. Robotics' largest competitors.
Hmm.
And we found that the inertia that USR had created in the marketplace, even though our product was quote-unquote compatible with, would run all the same software, there was something that just, you know, it wasn't exactly compatible, right? It couldn't be because it wasn't an exact copy of their product.
Right.
And that is something that really made it difficult for our organization. And, in fact, that company, Telebit, in many ways went out of business. Parts of it got sold and parts of it went out of business, all of which went back to someone else establishing the beachhead,
yep.
You know, another marketing word out there, and owning the customer relationship, owning it in their mind that they owned that category, being first, and then from that standpoint, it made it very difficult for someone else to enter. So when I think about the work that you're referring to, I think a lot of that just goes into understanding what is the buying cycle at the customer. So it's not only understanding your customers, we talked about earlier, and what you're selling and how you're going to sell it, but then, and I think I spent a lot of time on this in my book, is understanding how your customer buys. And the more your sales process matches the buying cycle, the more likely it is that you're going to win. I believe it's available on my website, and if it's not, I'll send you this chart. But just imagine that there are a number of steps between the time when a prospect has never ever heard of your company through to the time where they are recommending you to someone else.
Right? Okay.
Now, in my book, I have a chart which has, I think, something like 22 steps in that process. But everybody has their own sales process, if you will. Okay. The one I map out has all of these variations and sidebars and detours and so forth, and it's pretty complicated. But where I start with an organization might be helpful, and that I've developed a process around that, is that I have a little screening chart that they go through, and I say, well, look at this generic sales process. Tell me what steps do you get to in the sales process most often and then not move forward? So let's say the first step is research and understanding who we're selling to and the customer. And then maybe another step is lead sources. Do we get leads from other people, through trade shows, through advertising, through Google AdWords, right? Do you need help in that? Well, no, we get plenty of leads, but then we have trouble qualifying the leads, right? Mm. No, we don't have trouble qualifying the leads, but once we qualify them and we think that they have interest, well, they don't have the right budget, or they, even if we qualified them on budget, the timing might not be right, or you know what, they just don't return our phone calls. You know, they need us, but they don't want us, and so forth. So we walk through a whole step and understand where are the hurdles in the sales process.
Right, because there's usually one or two areas that where most of the stoppage.
And if any of your listeners are familiar with pipeline process, like you would have an ACT, for example, or Goldmine, and the pipeline is just lining up all of the people who you could possibly do business with and organizing them based on the likelihood of getting business from them in the near future, right?
Yeah.
So the ones that are at the top of the funnel are the ones that you may not even know their names yet, and the one at the bottom of the funnel are the ones that already become customers. Well, in those various steps, you'll see in a sales pipeline that occasionally, every month, the same name will show up, same customer name will show up at stage four. And next month they're at stage four. And next month they're at stage four.
Yeah.
And you ask the salesperson, well, why aren't we moving forward, right?
Yeah.
That's a hurdle. There's a
right.
problem there.
And generally what happens, he doesn't really know why.
He
can't get...
Right.
He's foggy.
Right. And what happens then on month five is they vaporize. They go off the chart completely because we don't know what's happened to them.
Right.
And also I'd say that that's the time we generally lose the business because we don't know what's going on. So what I've done in my book is to line up marketing activities that need to take place to help the sales team punch through those hurdles. And so it varies from one company to the next, not even the same industry. You could be competing in the same industry and really need very different marketing tools. Let me give you an example. We're in an area that I don't do work, but I think it's area that people know name brands. For example, there's a company called Caribou Coffee. Caribou Coffee is right in the same business as Starbucks. I mean,
yep.
You can't really tell the difference between the two as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
But
Starbucks
Caribou
is a little more bitter, maybe.
Yeah, maybe, right. But,
maybe.
I mean, for the most part, it's kind of hard to tell the difference,
right?
All right.
Yep.
Now, imagine you're Caribou Coffee and you're competing with Starbucks. How do you do that, right? You would really be stupid to use the same marketing tools that Starbucks has.
Mm.
Starbucks gets a lot of their branding, if you will, or customer following from finding it in the stores of national retail stores.
Mm.
Even Target carries Starbucks.
Right?
Right. Now, should Caribou start a campaign to get their brand inside of nationwide branded retailers? Probably not. They probably don't have the money to pay for the shelves. They need to come up with a whole different mechanism to get in front of their customers. And in fact, probably even make a decision, are they even in the same business? Could they create a different brand for themselves? Again, I'm making this stuff up. But they need different marketing tools than the people at Starbucks. And I say all that because there's been so many people that look at their competition and try to create a mirror image of everything that they're doing, thinking it's going to work for them and their salespeople, and it just doesn't.
Well, you know, you can't imitate Starbucks.
Right.
You could try.
But people do try.
And you could have the same, pretty pictures and the cool music and the stainless steel mugs and everything.
Right.
But then everybody that goes in there will go, oh, that's the place that's like Starbucks but isn't.
Right. Exactly. Right.
And it feels fake.
Yeah.
I mean, Starbucks, I mean, however contrived it may actually be, when I go there, it doesn't feel fake to me.
Right.
It's, well, this is Starbucks. This is where I come if I want to feel like this.
Yes.
Which is, isn't that what Starbucks is all about? I mean, I don't think it's really about the coffee.
It probably isn't about the coffee, because you can make it yourself.
That's right.
Right.
So Caribou, it's got this very Montana feel, and it's much more rustic and much less urban, I guess,
right?
And the coffee probably does taste different. I couldn't tell you exactly, but...
Right. But I think if you apply that to a small business, how you start... Certainly recognize that everybody's got competition. I don't care what the product is. A customer is buying something today to solve that problem. You know, they may be making something work that's not perfect, but they are solving that problem some way. And if you have an optimal solution, then your point is, how do I get that across in the least amount of time and gain the greatest traction with my customers, right? Which I think is our whole point of this call. How do you make that work?
Right.
And I would say that the process that I work through is having a very clear definition of what it is that you're selling. Try to create a new category if you can. And then the next step is really working through some of the things that you can do in marketing to help your sales team be the most effective. And when I say marketing, I don't mean logos and corporate ID. I mean things like you mentioned the Datalyzer slide chart, you know, things that really work.
You've worked with a lot of companies. Could you give me a couple of interesting examples of creating a category?
Sure.
Maybe with some of your clients or...
Yeah. A company that I'm working with right now, a company called Unitrends. Unitrends is in the... it's a technology firm, and they provide a very remarkable product that does backup and... instantaneous restoration of computer files, okay? And it's certainly, as we have come to know, that it's not a question of if my hard drive's going to fail, it's always when, right? It's a piece of mechanical art, if you will, and eventually it will fail. And so you're kind of crazy to think that it won't. It's not like insuring your home against fire, and most homes, of course, never, ever burn down. That's not the case with a hard drive. Hard drives will fail. I mean, it's just a matter of time. So one thing that we really worked on is to understand, so what's unique about this? What's unique about the product that they sell? Well, as it turns out...
And this is a competitive business.
Yeah, very competitive business. There's hundreds and hundreds of companies in this business.
So this is a great example.
Right. But you know, the one thing that we noticed that no one is really focused on is the small business. Everyone is focused on selling either a piece of software, which you can get for free almost, but I'm talking about an appliance that you know, like the your cable modem that you buy. Plug it in, and it's that simple, right?
Okay. This is sounding attractive.
Actually. Right, okay. And so we've done a remarkable job of changing the mindset in only focusing on small businesses of, let's say, $100 million and less. Now, that may sound like a big business to some of your listeners, but, you know, as far as the government's concerned, that's a small business. And there are millions of those businesses who have computer networks. They may have a couple of servers. They may have, 20 computers. They may be running some kind of applications. They probably have a mail server someplace, and they know that it's just a matter of time when something's going to go wrong. And honestly, the most likely thing that happens is that someone in their IT department applies a new Microsoft patch, which fails, and then the whole network goes down.
Mm.
Okay,
right.
And this allows you to rewind the clock, if you will.
Oh.
Okay, and say, okay, I applied that patch at noon today, and it didn't work. I'm going to rewind it back to what the state was of the network at 11:59,
gotcha.
And then I'm ready to go again, and I can deal with Microsoft separately.
Hmm.
So anyway, there's a lot of products that do that today. Okay, that do exactly what I described. But focused on the small business is something that rarely anyone has done. Now,
and there's a lot of us out there.
A lot of us out there, right? Which is okay, but that presents another problem: is that the way in which that product is sold to big business, we couldn't use any of those rules. We have to use different rules because small businesses find out about products differently. Small businesses find out about products through Google, right?
Right.
Right. They find out about products because they're recommended in the press. I mean, something you're an expert in editorial relations, and how do you work with a journalist, okay?
Yeah.
Well, that's something we've had to beef up on.
Mm.
We never had a white paper, okay? And you, an expert in white papers, we've learned that we need lots and lots of white papers, not one, but a lot of them, right?
Yeah.
And we need third parties to talk about how wonderful we are. And I think the last point that's very new for many companies, and that is you got to be public with all of the stuff that's going on internal your company. And you see this with user forums, for example, where all of the good and the bad is right out there for everyone to read. There's no secrets.
Right.
And so if a product has a problem, okay, product has a problem. And we deal with it in an open forum. And the more you can do that, again, this is a specific example, but that's something that we've seen just in the last year that has had tremendous traction for the organization to be open and honest about those kind of things. And it really drives small business traffic.
Did you ever read a book called The Clue Train Manifesto?
Yeah, sure.
This is five years old.
That's right.
The whole idea of the book was there's the inside of the company and the outside, and everybody on the outside wants to know
what's going on on the inside. Right. Right.
And the thing that most corporate people can't get is it's okay to tell them there's problems on the inside.
Right.
Then they know you're telling them the truth.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's like, okay, this backup system, it's not compatible with XYZ or whatever.
Right.
You say, yep, it's not.
Right.
We don't have a patch for that. We don't have an upgrade for that.
Right.
If you have to have this work, do not buy it, but everybody else, you'll, right?
Yeah, and so we needed, and this is another thing that I have really had just a great learning experience for myself. But Seth Godin wrote a book last year, which is called All Marketers Are Liars. and his point is not that all marketing people are liars. He's saying that to get you to buy the book. Right?
And
he tells you that too. Okay? But the point is that we all kind of lie to ourselves of who we're dealing with and what we're selling. And actually, that's not appropriate. And what we need to be doing, and this is one of those things that I really wish I knew a couple of years ago, like maybe 20 years ago, when I wasted $2.5 million in advertising. And that is, you know, so many of us spend time and effort selling to people, trying to sell to people, persuade people who actually will never be customers, right? And we should be spending time with people who are clearly right in the niche of this. You know, if you meet these requirements, you're a customer. And if you meet these requirements and you're not a customer, you're missing out.
Mm.
All right? And so for Unitrend's example, we even took what we consider a visual example of somebody that even looks like our customer. We gave him a name. We call him Floyd Addison, and he's Floyd's our guy. And we ask, is this something that Floyd would approve of? Would Floyd like this product? Would he agree with this next release of the product? And that way of thinking is so refreshing.
You're Floyd laughing. Develops as a fiction character.
Exactly Right, right. He does.
Well, John, I was talking to Floyd this morning. He put the kibosh on this.
And you know what? That has already happened. I'll tell you, it's really remarkable. But it's one of those things that I wish I had learned earlier in my career, because I really believe that all people are equal in their interest. You know, my point was, I'm such a good salesperson, I can sell, as they say, ice to Eskimos.
Yeah.
Right? Well, the point is, you don't want to sell ice to Eskimos. Right? Right. You want to sell your product to people who are going to recommend it to someone else. And if you work under that rule, you're more likely to have success than trying to sell your product to everybody. And by the way, you'll sleep better at night, which goes back to the Clutrain Manifesto of honesty and candor.
Right.
You know, one thing that Seth even talks about in his book, and this is not meant to be any kind of a political statement, but the reality, this is interesting, is that the country, the United States, is polarized. It's a fact.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah, so absolutely.
So
we can talk about that if you want to.
Go right ahead. But did Bush beat Kerry, or did he just do a better job of getting out his base than Kerry did? And if you read Seth's book, he supported John Kerry, and he has disappointment only, and he said this is what happened: George Bush did a better job of getting out his base, because he marketed to his base of the people who are more likely to vote for him. It's just a fact, right?
Right.
And so that's where the money got spent. And not trying to influence the middle, if you will.
Mm.
Who are the middle, you know? Which, you know, many people believe there is no such thing as the middle anymore, that you're on one side or the other. And all you really have to do is just figure out, how do you get more people that believe in you already to go to the polls that day? Because really, the percentage of Americans that vote anyway is so low.
Right.
Right. But anyway, we
might even want it to be low, because then it'll just be dumber and dumber people showing up at the polls.
That's true. Yeah, that's another whole subject. But you know, I think that from the standpoint of, you know, I'm thinking of your listener, small business owner, maybe not spending enough time on planning. Perhaps not enough investment behind him or her in launching an idea, balancing out the lack of capital with passion for their business, right? That they have a strong desire to move beyond maybe even another job during the day and really focus on something that they're really called to, and sometimes it may even be something that they're good at and a hobby. Right.
Right.
Where they want to make money.
Absolutely.
You know, so what's the advice that you give them? And really the advice of, you know, other than something like follow your heart, right,
yeah,
is to really market to the people who are most likely to recommend you to someone else. And put it, if necessary, put a name on that person and be honest with that person. And then figure out how do you get in front of them most in the most economic fashion.
Now, you talked about funding, and this is something that, as far as people listening to this, there's going to be every imaginable range of familiarity with that topic. I mean, I've been involved in, a company trying to raise angel money and selling to public companies, and you have too, a lot of that. There's probably a lot of people listening to this who... maybe they should go get funding. They've never actually considered it other than their uncle or their parents or somebody. But could you talk about that? You know,
you bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of different sources of funding. And again, I feel like I'm just at a book talk here, because Guy Kawasaki's book, The Art of the Start, really spends a lot of time on this. And in fact, if you go to Art of the Start, the review section on Amazon, you'll see my review of that book.
Mm.
And I say, if I had known this, if I had read this book in 1985, I would have saved $2.5 million in my job.
Wow.
And here's the point about funding. Any time that someone makes an investment in your business, you have to pay them back with something. Now, if they make an investment by way of buying stock in your company, or they become, you know, God forbid, a partner of your firm, they end up having some ownership of whatever it is that you create. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, they also may incur some of the losses along with you, especially in a partnership case. So, you know, that regardless of what you're out there selling, whether it's stock or a partnership or some sort of a joint venture, you have to recognize that it's very dangerous waters. And I'll tell you what smart money is today, and this is something that Guy talks about in his book, and that is the most important thing that you can go do is to go sell something. And if people aren't going to buy, then clearly no one's going to invest. And if you can figure out how to sell what it is that you've made, then the investors will come along. That will just happen. If you have such an amazing idea for a product, and it, let's say it takes, you know, you're going to dream up the next Amazon.com, and you recognize that it's going to take $100 million to get it off the ground. In this day and age, it won't get funded unless you have a track record. And so...
Nor should it.
Exactly.
Nor should it.
Nor should it.
Right.
And so the smart money, the smart thinking today, and again, you read about this in Guy's book, is that if you are that smart and you have come up with such a terrific idea, you have a couple of options, and only a couple. And one is that you go find a company that maybe you don't want to sell them anything, but will hire you as a contractor or a consultant to develop it inside their own organization, and that they get a piece of the pie when you're done.
Mm-hmm.
All right? But there is a vested interest of making it happen. You know, you cover some of your costs, they cover some of their costs, and at the end of the day, the risk is shared, but they're not an investor in your business. Another way of looking at it is you're essentially becoming a consultant. And a lot of people don't like that idea. They don't want to become a consultant for someone else. They believe that they can get there faster. You know, they can become the next Bill Gates. You know, if that's the case, they're probably not going to be listening to this broadcast.
You never know.
But, you know, again, the smart thing you can do is to latch on to as many people as possible who may be willing to give you an advance order. And the advance order might be for your own brain power. Now, one thing that, in fact, I did to launch a company, a product inside of a company, I was with a company called Telebit. And Telebit, as I mentioned, is in the modem business. This is my next stop after U.S. Robotics. And we had developed a product that was really a terrific modem for sending data over cellular phone networks. Now, this is way back. This is in 1991, I believe. And cellular telephony is nothing developed. But let me tell you, we were achieving data speeds equivalent to what we're achieving now. Now, what I don't tell you is that the thing was the size of a bread box. You know, so it's nothing that you just kind of carried around with you on what we call a laptop, because a laptop back then, of course, was something that would break your back.
Right.
You know, mine I carried in an Anvil case, which weighed at least 80 pounds. But nonetheless, we had some very interesting technology, but we needed to develop it further. So in my work as a salesperson, we identified some likely prospects of who really needs this, one of which was a company called Southwestern Bell Mobile Systems. And SBMS was at that time located down in San Antonio. And we worked with that group. We, in fact, had great success. And they gave us an advance order, which I think was about $2.5 million. And we didn't deliver on that for many, well, at least a year later. And so we were able, though, to take that order and do something with it. And we were able to bank that.
Oh.
And that had value to an investor group because we could show them traction, if you will.
Right.
That we had a customer lined up once we developed these. Now, Southwestern Bell never made an investment in our company. But what they did do is they gave us a purchase order, and the purchase order had the terms of which, you know,
yep,
we wanted to see, and
yep,
and really the rest is history. That technology became the basis of DSL technology, by the way.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
But Talbot never got to enjoy the fruits of their labor, if you will.
Well, you know, I always, like in coaching programs, consulting calls, one of the things I always talk about with respect to Google AdWords is if you can buy a trickle of traffic for, you know, $1 and make $2 on it, then you have the seed of something that can become very, very big.
Yep.
Okay? Or really, more importantly, if your competitors are buying the traffic for $1 and making $1.90, and you're buying the traffic for $1 and making $2,
right.
If you're a little bit better than them, eventually everything will accrue to you because you can pay affiliates more, you can spend more on advertising, you can feed your growing thing faster, and that's the whole... So on in pure internet, you can reduce this to a mechanical set of steps, okay? And what you're describing is you reduced it to, I went to Southwestern Bell, and I got this giant purchase order that I don't have to fulfill until so many months from now, but it's the same thing. I mean, if you can prove that I buy this traffic and it's more valuable when it comes out the other side, you get an affiliate to invest in, even though you're not paying them anything up front. You get, if you can totally prove everything on paper, well, this is what my affiliates are doing, this is what my Google traffic is doing, this is what my banner ads on this banner network are doing. Why couldn't you? You should be able to get a banker just about. I mean, maybe not literally. But this is banking. Marketing is banking.
Well, in that case, it is. And again, my presupposition is always that marketing is there to help the salespeople be more effective. And so, you know, unless you happen to be in the retail business, the sales team owns the customer relationship. So that's why I think I've been pretty successful in my career, and I've always looked at marketing as tools that salespeople have in their bag, And so, some cases it is just a name that makes a difference, I was with a firm earlier last week, and we had a couple of people look at a new company name, and they said, I'll invest based on company name only because it's so strong. Now, that happens very infrequently, but it was a strong name. And again, because the name said what it was that they did, and they happen to own the domain name, and all those kind of things lined up like the stars and the planets. But I think that has a lot to do with being able to get to the point where a customer will give you the kind of feedback and the kind of order that you're intending.
You've seen a lot of companies come and go. You've been in some cases intimately or at least peripherally involved. What are, so when you divide the winners from the losers, what are some maybe not so obvious things that most of the winners have different from the losers?
The winners clearly have a good sense of who it is that they're selling to, and I know we've talked about that already. But they really have let's say it's even beyond a good sense of who they're selling to, but they can talk in that person's language. And so if they're selling to a scientist, they look like a scientist, If they are selling to a soccer mom, quote-unquote, that's what they look like. They don't try to be something that they're not, and they have the right kind of language skills, even down to the way that they answer their phones. And it creates a sense of mission, I think, of what they're all about and the kind of person that they service. You know, and I'll give you another example that many of your listeners certainly have experienced, and that is Southwest Airlines. You know, Southwest Airlines has a kind of a particular customer, and it appeals to certain people. There's a lot of people that don't enjoy flying on Southwest, right?
Maybe yeah. all of them.
Yeah. And you know, what do they find that they don't like? Well, you know, a lot of people like to get assigned seats. You know, and a lot of people don't like the kidding around that you have on an airplane, right?
Yep.
You know, letting children make announcements on the aircraft while it's flying, that kind of thing, right? Or that, you know, I remember one I was relating the story to a friend, and a couple of years ago I was on a flight around Christmas time, and I was flying back from Dallas, and the pilot came on and said, I believe it was the pilot, but it may have been the flight attendant. I mean, someone came on and said, hey, folks, let's sing some carols. And we had 130 of us singing Christmas carols all the way home, right? But we had a wonderful time. I was relating that story to another person just last week. And he said, oh, my gosh, I'd never get my work done. Because to them, being on an airplane is their time to retreat, be in the cocoon, do some work, right?
Right.
I'm like, man, I would never want that. So, you know, and I think that they have a very clear definition of who their customer is, as we said, and they talk to their customers like that.
Hmm.
Again, look at the Southwest website. Compare that to United Airlines, for example.
Oh, brother.
United Airlines has got a beautiful website,
yeah.
right? Southwest, very stripped down,
right?
Just like their airplanes,
right?
Right. Now, of course, who's making money right now is a whole other story.
But, you know, my first thought is, I don't remember the last time I tried to buy something on United, and it might have been too long ago to be relevant, but it was a nightmare.
Sure.
You go to Southwest, it ain't too hard to figure out how to get the plane ticket to Dallas.
Right, right,
you know?
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, United is, what a mess, you know?
And they're putting it back together again, which is good to see. But I happen to know that the reason for that is that they are really focused on who their customer is. I mean, this is fresh information. The Wall Street Journal wrote a beautiful story on them. And they decided that they sell to the business client. Unbelievable, shocking news, right? Right?
And they only spent $40 million finding that out, I'm sure, right?
But, you know, everybody's capable of making that error. You think that everybody looks like a customer, and the fact is they're not.
That's true.
So you asked, you know, what are the traits of the folks that do a good job of that? You know, one is certainly know that. The second thing is really being very slow. And as I think there's a book by this title, Hire Slow, Fire Fast. And having the right people is so important. You know, when I think about when I was responsible for hiring you, you know, I remember the discussions was, well, Perry's going to be a quality guy, right? And why you need those kind of people in your company at certain times is that the company's going to change and morph for about, you know, the next 5 years and become a very different company, and you have to have people that are pretty agile and that they're going to be comfortable with that, right? And once a company matures, that takes a different kind of employee to be there. And that's probably why you're not there anymore, right? The company changed into something completely different.
Well, yes to both. It was very, I mean, it was turbulent. There was always a crisis going on, and there was all kinds of stuff. But, yeah, we had to, like, hold the ship together.
Right, right.
And, once we got that past that stage and we were going to be, like, you know, business as usual for some public company, okay, I'm out of here. I'd be bored, you know.
Yeah, so the personnel is really important. You know, and honestly, if I have to put my money in the most appropriate place, it has to do with what kind of salespeople am I going to have. I mean, if there's one area that I think most entrepreneurs get tripped up, and I could give you chapter and verse of so many others, that they have a pretty good technical group. In fact, many of them are the makers of the technology themselves. But they get tripped up and they don't know how to hire salespeople. And the salespeople don't properly represent them. They're a different personality. their clients now all of a sudden see them as something that they're not. They may have 5 salespeople, all of which working out of their own home offices, that only get back to corporate once or twice a year. And what ends up happening is you have those people in the field all delivering very different messages. And, you know, the customers that are in the Northeast don't look anything like the customers in the Southwest.
Oh.
Okay? And so that all comes back to...
Well, that's a fun problem to straighten out.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, that problem happens more often than any other that I've seen.
Wow.
It's just that whole consistency of hiring salespeople, because the entrepreneur thinks that salespeople are just different, and so they hire anybody that looks good. And the fact of the matter is, that's a really poor choice, because they're out there as your missionaries every day.
How would you, let's say you had to go hire 3 salespeople.
Uh-huh.
Let's say that you had to hire 1 on the East Coast, 1 in the Midwest, 1 on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And this is for a client,
okay.
Let's say that you
sure.
have. And they say, okay, John, go.
Right.
Go figure out our hiring Could you tell me some perhaps interesting things that you would do to get that off the ground, and where you might find them, and
sure.
how you would make those choices?
Okay. Well, first off, my own personal feeling on that is something that I learned at the College of Hard Knocks, and that is, if you have a small business, the most important thing is that you need everybody, what I'll call in-country. They all need to be under the same roof, feeling the pain every day, seeing what's going on in the shipping dock if you have one, seeing the engineers, working inside the organization. I don't care what product or service it is. So you'll never see me as a fan of remote offices until much, much, much later. And I'm talking about when you're about $100 million.
Really?
I really prefer to have salespeople work in a home office and travel when they need to go see somebody. And U.S. Robotics was a perfect example of that. That's something that I actually fought. I was not a proponent of the way that Casey wanted to set things up. He wanted to keep all the salespeople inside the office, as now I'm a fan of as well.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, no, we want to expand. Let's have people all over the place. In fact, let's move the people that we have into remote offices, right? Well, what happens is... they miss out on what happens in the company. And you spend more time communicating with them about what's going on inside the company, back to your your book the Clue Train Manifesto, than anything else. So I start there, and where am I going to hire these people from? The second thing that I look for is just raw personality. You know, I want to know, same kind of questions that I asked you. You know, if I don't fund you in marketing and you have nothing, I'd like to know how you're going to rub 2 sticks together to make a fire, right? What are you going to do? What are you bringing to the party? Tell me what kind of tools you need in order to be successful. You know, that's the kind of things that I want to see. And honestly, I want them to see if they can, how good they are in delivering a sales pitch on the fly, because that's kind of the way it is. I'm not a fan of the Rolodex, as they say. You know, a lot of organizations hire you because of where you just came from, and they say, I want your Rolodex. I found that that's actually, that falls into the same category of, you know, do you believe in open book tests or in closed book tests? I believe in open book tests. Well, why? Because I think it's more important for people to know how to find the answer as it is to memorize the answer.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And so I like sure. salespeople who can just, they know how to go solve a problem. You know, they're problem solvers. Then I am somebody that's just done it 100 times, and you're asking them to do it 101st, and you get them out of their comfort zone 1 time, and they fall apart. That's what I'm always looking for the agile person, especially in a small business.
You know, there's a thread that's running through everything that you've described here. Which is, I would call it, matching cultures.
Yeah.
It's like...
Good point.
It's like, you said, like, if your customers are all scientists...
Yes.
Then when the scientists pick up the phone and call your... Let's say they're all university they're all university professors, right, or right. something. Well, obviously, your company is not a university.
Right.
But it needs to feel like one.
Yep.
And why does it feel like one? Well, not because somebody painted University of Iowa logos or something, but because the people come from that kind of background and they have an appreciation.
Sure.
And there's all this, in a culture like that, there's all of this nonverbal, non-explicit stuff that comes through.
Right.
Which is exactly what the remote sales guy doesn't ever pick up.
That's right.
I have a friend who's deaf, and he said the worst thing about being deaf is that, or one of the bad things about being deaf, he reads lips. Like, he talks funny, but you can get along sure. okay with him in a right. conversation. But he said one of the real downers of it is that everything you know is only what is explicitly told you.
Right.
It has to be told you directly, mm-hmm. you know, verbally
sure.
from you to them, right. or you have to read it on a piece of paper,
yeah.
and you miss all the stuff that comes over the transom, as we
right.
would say.
Right.
And he said that it makes you totally out of tune with everyone.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's kind of that's the remote sales guy problem, right? Yeah. Or that's the MBA who says, we've identified this market, they have these certain drivers, there's $190 million last year,
right.
we're going to go into it, and he gets the culture all wrong.
Right.
He doesn't know, hey, these are customers, they want to sing on the airplane,
right.
and you're giving them a library.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is so... And then, you know, okay, what kind of people do I... Well, we hire people that match us. They match our customers. They...
Exactly. Right.
And and this is all true down to even one person.
But here's the trouble that you have, is that a company will start out because they want to solve a problem. All right? They're passionate about it.
Yeah.
I don't care what the problem is.
Yeah.
That's how they all start off. And then they have some success. And they actually sell to some people who have that problem. And they have a loyal cult following. Then they have to go big time.
Mm.
They're going to go to a bigger audience.
Yeah.
And somewhere along the line, they learn that the bigger audience is interested in something a little bit different. It's a different kind of buyer. It's a different kind of culture. It's a different kind of thing altogether. And then they have to make a decision, do they want to try to sell to that company or those type of organizations? And most fail because they are more interested in staying who they are, right, than changing their behavior to look more like their customers. So you're right, it's a matching of cultures, and it is a real difficult decision. Because at some point, customers do have expectations of what a supplier looks like.
Yeah.
And if that is in the sweet spot of your business, and you've uncovered something that multinational businesses need, and then you need to look like a supplier, right? Somebody that they want to buy from.
I've got here your book, The Marketing Playbook. This is a very clever book. I've given it away to a couple of customers. It's 102 of the best marketing plays to get your sales team across the goal line, and every play is a page.
Right.
And you know, so like play number 38 is video news release.
Mm-hmm.
And this outlines, okay, if you're going to do video news releases.
Right.
You need this, this, this. You need these people
right.
on your team to do certain functions. Here's how much it's going to cost.
Mm-hmm.
It's got this little section called coaching points. Your goal is 20 seconds of news on a major network and full 60 on news breaks. And I mean, it goes through it. This is a really dense book.
Right.
There is a lot of stuff.
I can tell you from how long it took me to write it. Yes, there's a lot of information there.
Well, so first of all, I want to bring this up as an outstanding resource.
Thanks.
People can buy this at?
You can buy it at Amazon or on my website, adventuremarketing.com. Obviously, I'd prefer you buy it direct because I make more money. Amazon takes 60% of the total, so obviously I don't make a lot of money on the book. But it is meant to be a textbook on marketing, but it is a visual textbook. And every marketing element in there is described in a photograph of what that particular element's supposed to do for you. And then I also give you some coaching points, as you said. And I think the most important is probably lost a little bit graphically, and that is I also mapped each of these plays onto the sales chart, the sales process we talked about a few minutes ago, and where it's most likely to help you get across the goal line. And if you've got a hurdle, let's say at some point of staying in touch with customers that are already customers, you might consider some form of print-on-demand postcards, for example, as I give you an example there.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you how to go use that and also expose you to all of the vendors that I've used. All of the vendors in the book are ones that I've used in the past and highly recommend.
That means 100 vendors of things like video services.
Right.
And, I mean, these are things that, in most cases, if you screw it up, your project is not fun, right?
Oh, well, some of them, yeah.
You know, if your vendor, I mean, some of these, if the vendor's bad,
right.
It's a bad day for everyone.
Yeah, well, I think vetting of vendors is probably the biggest value this book provides.
Which is not at all immediately obvious just from picking the book up, but it bears repeating. So, I mean, you've got really 20 years of stuff compressed into 100 pages.
Yeah.
Not bad, John.
Thanks.
Not bad. So, yeah, go to venturemarketing.com and learn about John's playbook. I know you've got a few other things that readers would be interested in or participate in.
Yeah, I'm two things. One is by the time this is out, I will be getting my newsletter up and running. So there's obviously a contact us spot that they can decide if they want to get on my newsletter list. And also, I'm launching my blog soon. The blog is called Lumpy Marketing. And Lumpy Marketing is what I say. That's what gets done either 2 or 3 weeks before a trade show or when someone gets around to it or they happen to have some money to spend. And that, of course, is not the way a good organization operates. That even if you only have $1,000 to spend for an entire year, right, smart marketing is all about how do I appropriately apply that throughout the year so that I don't have these blips. But, you know, again, you know, we talked about some of the company mistakes that are made. That again, is a mistake that I see made over and over again, that they'll spend money only when it's necessary and only when it's right before a trade show generally or something big. And they don't have enough money set aside to last throughout the entire year.
Mm.
So the salespeople end up being starved typically sometime during the year, right? Because they don't have any lead sources. They don't have anything to bring to a customer. They don't have a new white paper coming, or they haven't invested in Google AdWords. And, you know, they don't have you on retainer, let's say, you know, to get some coaching on a very regular basis. And those are just, you know, really not smart ways of running a business. But that's yet why so many businesses fail.
Gotcha. So in other words, the Lumpy Marketing is a tongue-in-cheek way of describing this kind of haphazard, herky-jerky way.
It's really what you don't want to do. But again, I found that it's more important for me to state a problem as a pain point rather than as a vitamin, right? And so I'll talk about it, things like, you know, in fact, the little start, it says, you've got lumpy marketing, right? And then I describe what lumpy marketing is, and then how do you get around that? What are the smart tools? How do you, what kind of people do you need? What resources? How do you go about formulating a business plan and so forth?
And all of this is at venturemarketing.com.
Yeah.
So you can check out the marketing playbook.
Right.
you can check out your blog and your newsletter.
Yep.
The Launchpad newsletter,
right.
Which I get. So, very good. Well, John, thank you. This was great.
Thank you very much for your time. It's awesome.